Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Now available on Apple Podcasts,
Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Podcast One presents the Steve Austin Show Classics.
All right, everybody, I'm sitting here talking to Justin Credible. Justin, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Steve. How are you doing, brother?
Man, I am doing outstanding. For the record, I'm just going to call you PJ, basically what I've always called you. I'm back in the day, in my early WWF days, you were wrestling as Aldo Montoya, but nonetheless, we'll stick with PJ today. And, man, I tell you what, I got a direct message from you a while back. I've been wanting to have you on the show. And I was driving down the road today, and I said, man, you know what? Today would be a good day to have your ass on the show. So I reached out, was able to get in touch with you, and I'm glad you could be on the show. You've got a lot of interesting things going on right now. But I want to go back because I was reading a little bit about you, and I didn't know, as long as I've known you, back in the WWF days, that you broke in the dungeon there in Calgary with Stu Hart.
Yeah, I did. You know, things that when I went through in the summer of 92, the things weren't, and it wasn't necessarily the dungeon. Things had changed a little bit in those days. Brute and Keith Hart, you know, Brett and Owen's brothers, they were in charge of it. Stu was at the time of training guys, but I went over there, and Lance Storm, Chris Jericho were in the camp the year previous to when I went through. And, you know, I got myself one hell of a good wrestling education. My first 10 matches were in Calgary in the fall and winter of 1992. And, you know, it's I tell you, when you say you came from the Harts up in Calgary, it kind of carries some weight with you. So it was the best decision I ever made. And I learned the basics real well up there by those guys. And you know that, you know.
But then were you down actually in the basement? Or if you're working with Keith and who else?
Bruce. You know, at that time, man, you know, they basically, what we did was we rented a little space outside of Calgary, like a couple miles outside the big city, and, you know, we'd set the ring up once a week. We'd go in there, you know, and just hammer it out every day. But no, I've been to the basement once, and I didn't actually, to be in full disclosure, I didn't do anything, but we did go to Stu's Hart. And we saw the infamous dungeon, but to be honest, I had one of those stories, you know.
So how long did the camp last, and what did you pay to learn how to wrestle over there in Calgary?
Oh, God, it was, I paid $3,000 Canadian back in 92, and what we did, we went up there, it was a two-month deal where we, you know, basically, I'm a Connecticut Northeast guy, I went up, you know, bought my own plane ticket, went up to Calgary, it was 2 months, we wrestled Monday through Friday for three hours a day, Monday through Friday, at the weekends off, for 2 months. And pretty much after that two-month period, you know, when you were done, you were done. It's a little different than the way some camps do it today. But, you know, in the beginning, first week, you know, we didn't even touch we didn't go in the ring. We did a lot of that. You know, they kind of tried to weed you out. Even back in when I started, you know, we'd do a lot of running, a lot of Hindu squats, and a lot of drills up and down to kind of, you know, see who had, you know, the attitudes, if everybody had a good attitude, if you didn't, if you were willing to do what you had to do. So, you know, it was really interesting. And, you know, 10 of us, put it this way, 10 of us started, only three of us left. And, you know, pretty cool deal, you know.
Well, you know, basically, you know, running for a two-month program, if you're running 5 days a week and you're in that ring a couple hours a day, I mean, you can actually get a pretty good education in a short amount of time with that amount of frequency.
Absolutely, and I really did. I mean, I didn't know anything back in the day. You know, 92, there was no internet. I wasn't that, you know, I was a smart fan, but I didn't subscribe to the dirt sheet, so I didn't know anything. I mean, you know, I went up there on a wing and a prayer on you know, and they pretty much just told me, hey, I mean, I stayed in a little motel with a couple of the other guys from the school, and just kind of put everything in these, you know, in their hands. And
now,
it was a great experience.
But what made you pick the Harts all the way up in Calgary? Is because you being in the Connecticut area, it was a little bit closer. Was there not a great school within striking reach there in the States?
I'm sure there was. Now that I learned, there was a Monster Factory. There was Johnny Rods in Brooklyn, New York, which is an hour and a half. But I had no idea of, you know, who or where to get a hold of. You know, Pro Wrestling Illustrated happened to have this ad that I saw, and I just corresponded to the ad because I knew that's what I wanted to do. And that was the only way my only in. So I called Bruce Hart, and he kind of, you know, got me up there, gave me all the information, and I went for it.
So you said you had your first 10 matches up there in Calgary. Did you get on the road and make some pretty long shots? Because I always heard that Calgary territory was notorious for some of the long drives that you had to make.
Very long drives. Cold, you know, in the middle of nowhere, you'd go into a lot of native Indian territories and reservations. I was up there, actually, Chris Jericho was my second ever professional match. And Lance Storm was like either 5 or 6, but they were my first 10 matches were up there. And we didn't do as much traveling as they did back in the old Stampede days. There were more spot shows. What they'd do is they'd run once a week. Remember the old Saddle Dome, the Calgary Saddle Dome?
Yes.
They'd run a little community center right across the street from it. And that's where I kind of cut my teeth in the very beginning.
So how was the match with Lance Storm and Chris Jericho? I mean, they were a few years into their career. Here you are, new cat out of the blocks. How'd they treat you? Did they shine you up, give you a full-blown match, take care of you?
Yeah, they did. I mean, Chris was super, but Lance even more. I mean, Lance and I were, we've always been, since those days, we've been very close. And, he took care of me. I mean, Chris could lay it in there, boy, if he wants to. And he kind of gave me a good whipping. But it was, he was cool, took some bumps for me and stuff. And, he was really cool. And, but Lance really went out there and, tried to really make me look good. And, he kind of, made me, he knew what I did well and knew what I didn't do well. And he kind of just made me look way better than I was at that stage in the game,
You're working in Canada. Come on back to Connecticut. And so what'd you do? Just go to WWF and say, hey, man, here I am. Can you give me a job? How'd that thing pan out?
Well, I mean, basically, when I got back here, I didn't know anybody. And that was one of the mistakes, I guess, I did make. And I didn't know anything. But I had no connections here in the Northeast. I somewhere down the line ran into Paul Roma, who was working out at a local, it was like a gym / red, they had a ring. It wasn't even a wrestling ring, it was like a boxing ring. And he was working out there, and he had a group of kids that he was training. So I would go down there every Sunday, or whenever, every other Sunday, whatever it was, and just, get in the ring, and, I kind of introduced myself, and, just wanted to get in the mix and meet other people. And, he just said, hey, man, I'm Tony Gurria. He knows Tony, and that's kind of how it started. He said one day, just, hey, there's a house show in New Haven. Just go down there, introduce yourself. And, New Haven's like 20, 30 miles from my house. So went down to the old New Haven Coliseum, which doesn't even exist anymore. They tore it down. But, just walked back there with my gear, not knowing anything about the business, not knowing how ridiculous, I would look or whatever. But I said, hey, Mr. Gurria, my name is Pete Polacco. I was trained by the Hearts up in Calgary. I said, if you ever need anybody, I'm here, I'm local. And he goes, well, tonight we're okay, but as a matter of fact, we have this new show that's starting in Manhattan called Monday Night Raw. And we're going to need some extras, so, and that's kind of how it started.
I love the Tony Gurria impression.
Well, I mean, I'm not very good at impressions.
No, but it sounded kind of like Tony.
Yeah. So that's kind of how it was, man. And I was so naive, man. The beauty of all of this is I was so naive, Steve, that I just kind of, like today I wouldn't have the hey, I got my bag, I was just so young and so dumb that it kind of worked for me. And I guess, but also what made him listen, and I kind of saw the look in his eyes, is when I said, yes, sir, I was trained by the Hearts. That kind of is like, oh, really?
Yeah, that opens up a lot of eyes and ears.
Yeah, absolutely. So
but the business has changed these days. I mean, back in the day, I mean, there was a couple of diesel rigs, 18-wheelers in the parking lot. But these days, I mean, if there was 4 back in the day, there's 20 now. And so it's just kind of a monster just to walk up on that thing with your bag in your hand and say, hey, man, I got trained by the Hearts. I got some gear.
Yeah.
You guys need a hand.
Yeah.
Oh, sure, kid, come on in. It ain't like it anymore.
What? Right, and you know what intimidates me? I would actually like to go see some of the fellas more than I do. But in my ego, I would, because now they have, back then they had no secure. You remember how it was.
Yeah.
You just drive back there, whatever. It didn't matter. But now it's like, I'd be mortified if I went back there to maybe, a TV taping or a house show. And, security was like, who the hell are you? And wouldn't let me back. I'd be crushed, because I don't have the cachet of some of the other guys that might be more well known. And so many things have changed. Talent relations has changed. The boys have changed. the whole, you know, it's kind of a different, like you said, it's a monster, it's a different deal. So yeah, it wouldn't fly today is what I'm saying.
You seem to have learned the business at a very rapid pace and turned into an outstanding hand in the ring. How was the training there with the Harts? I mean, did you gravitate or just learn the business and all the mechanics? Did you pick it up pretty fast?
I really did. I mean, you know, I hate to, this sounds kind of corny, but, you know, when I was a kid and I'd say 15 years old, I was already trying to mimic the stuff in the backyard. Before there was, I wasn't a backyard wrestler, but you know, you get your younger brother or your buddies from, you know, school or whatever. And I always wanted to do it. I've known that was what I wanted to do for a long, my whole life. That's all I ever wanted to do. So we'd always do that. So I never, you know, I didn't know, you know, hey, you got to work the left arm or right. Those things, but I kind of knew, look, this is what the business is. It's a give and take.
Who did you look up to as far as work was, you know, as far as any kind of influence on your stuff in the ring? Who did you look to?
Oh, huge Ricky Steamboat, man. The Flair Steamboat 89 feud, and even after that, like the whole Terry Funk, Ric Flair thing, I just, you know, that was what I really loved. I mean, I was a New York guy because of where I lived, you know, NWA didn't come out here very much, but we had it on WTBS, obviously, and, you know, that stuff was just different than what Vince was doing at the time, you know, that more Hulk Hogan kind of cartoonish stuff, whereas I gravitated to the competition and you know, as like Steamboat and Flair, and that really is what captured my imagination as a young man.
But that was interesting, and you said that as I was waiting for you to take a break there. So, you know, here's a guy in WWE's or WWF's background or a front yard, and you're digging the stuff that's coming out of the Carolinas and Atlanta.
Yeah, absolutely, man, absolutely.
So there in the WWF at the time, was there anybody that you liked what they were doing in the ring?
Absolutely.
That was kind of the era of the big man, wasn't it?
It really was. I mean, you know, even back then, it was, you know, Owen, who was not a small man at all, but was a small guy.
Yeah.
You know, back then. You know, I remember for the first time when I met Ted DiBiase, the Million Dollar Man. I was standing. You know, I introduced myself. And he was very generous, shook my hand and stuff. But I was looking at this guy. I mean, he was just tall and thick, and you know, he was in his wrestling trunks, and his thighs were just a mountain of a man. And I was like, oh my God, these guys are beasts. You know, it was just the difference was immense. You know, but I loved Ted. I loved Marty. I loved Sean. I was really into, and also another guy I was into was like Brian Pillman, that high fly, because that's what I thought I had to be. You know, I was, at the time, I was 6 foot, maybe 200 pounds at the most. I thought if I'm going to have any success, I'm going to have to fly. I'm going to have to be quick. So I always looked to those guys to emulate, to try to model my work after, if I could even dare say that. But you know what I'm saying? That you know, high fly and stuff that was kind of coming into its own at that time.
And, you know, so there you are in WWF. And so you incorporated some of the high flying stuff into your own act as Aldo Montoya, the Portuguese Man of War. Now, how was it that they just came to you and said, hey, check it out, PJ, we got this idea. We want to call you Aldo Montoya, because of your Portuguese heritage. So how did they lay this gimmick on you, and what were your thoughts?
Well, it was, I live 45 minutes from Stamford, still do. And at the time, Mark Undertaker was doing that thing with Brian Lee where the double Undertaker
fake
were coming
Undertaker.
Out for for the SummerSlam deal. And, you know, they needed a crash test dummy, basically. They're all week in Stamford for, you know, they look, come in, we'll pay you $150 a day, just work out with Brian and Mark and, you know, do whatever they need you to do, which I did. It was a great experience. But on the Friday, you know, it was the week before the weekend before TV was on a Monday, Vince and Pat had come down and it was a full dress rehearsal. They wanted to see what Brian looked like in the gear. So, you know, Mark was with Vince and Pat checking it all out, and Brian had the whole, you know, the whole Undertaker ring gear, makeup, everything, and we went through what we'd worked on. It was just for them to see, you know, Brian's mannerisms, see if he looked like Mark or not. Nothing to do with me. Anyways, it went well. At the end of it, you know, Pat kind of pulled me aside. I said, thank you very much, kid, blah, blah, blah. They started asking me, you know, just some pedigree questions, like, hey, you know, where were you trained? I was like, oh, I was trained again by the heart, sir. You know, very respectful, of course, you know. And he goes, really? And he goes, how long, you know, have you been working? I said, oh, a little over a year. He goes, well, what nationality are you? And I said, well, I'm Portuguese. When I said that, he popped to Vince. He goes, hey, Vince, you're a goddamn kid Portuguese. You didn't even say it right, you know, just French-Canadian accent. And I, you know, and I kind of, I was like, okay, what's, well, maybe they don't like Portuguese, whatever. No big deal, whatever. And anyways, and then Pat asked me the most important question was, do you speak it? And I said, yes, sir, I do, which I do. And I said that to Vince as well. And Vince, oh, you know, very good. You know, the deal there. And, well, the whole time, I guess, back in those days, they were doing kind of crappy in the, you know, the local markets, the, you know, domestic stuff. The attendance was down. So they were looking for different international acts to, you know, because our stuff was stronger overseas. And it was not even about Europe. It was more to go to South America because Brazil is probably the biggest country in South America, and that's their
right.
Language is Portuguese. So that was the intention, which never took off. But the intention was to have a Portuguese-speaking guy to kind of, you know, be able to go out there and do some stuff. So that's how I got my break.
Okay, so they say, we want to call you Aldo Montoya. Now, I know the answer to this question is going to be, yes, that sounds great. Where do I sign up?
Right. they pitched that whole thing, you know, and back then they had, like, I forgot what they call it, man. But, you know, they had a whole, you know, they had the cartoon character drawings. And at first, Aldo was a soccer player.
Right.
Because it was like it was 94. So the World Cup, it was a World Cup year. So soccer, you know, soccer was getting bigger here. And so Aldo was this dude with long hair and, you know, he was dribbling a soccer ball with a number 21 on his, you know, in the jersey. And that was the original thing. But I always said to creative, I was like, guys, Aldo is not a Portuguese name. It's actually Italian. And Montoya is like Spanish, Latino.
Yeah.
So nothing. There's not a hint of Portuguese in that. You know what I'm saying? But you know, what am I? I'm just getting the opportunity here. I'm not going to say.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not going to put up much of a fight. So I mentioned it to them. It would kind of just went over their heads. So Aldo Montoya was, and about a week and a half, 2 weeks before I actually had to debut, is when they threw that costume on me, and the first time I wore the costume or tried on the mask or anything like that was the night I debuted. And I'd never worked under a mask, never had a television match before. I'm used to, you know, putting guys over, you know, getting squashed or, you know, just enhancing the talent.
Right.
So now, you know, for the first time I'm putting this jock strap on my head to get over, which I had no idea how to get over. I was just,
right.
You know, so it was, it was what it was, you know, and it's just a miracle that I even pulled any of this off, to be honest with you, Steve.
Well, let's talk about this. Let's cut in here because on YouTube, you have some videos which are called Pro Wrestling 101, and you cover different subject matter. And I didn't watch all of them. I've watched four or five or six of them, and they're very informative, and they're very to the point, and I would tend to agree with just about everything you're saying on these things. Things such as locker room etiquette, tag teams, selling, promos, putting together a character, learning from the veterans, storytelling, staying in shape, all kinds of different things. So tell me a little bit about working under a mask, because I don't think you've covered that on your 101 stuff. How was that? Because, I mean, it was a different kind of mask. Is it harder to show your emotions? You kind of eliminates the facials. What was your learning curve in learning to work with that mask?
It was a little bit. I mean, first of all, it really, even though it wasn't like the lucha masks.
Right.
That, you know, I can't understand how people work with those things because I've tried and it's very difficult. But you feel hyperventilated because, you know, the strap came across your chin, and it was just very claustrophobic, and my nerves at the time too. I mean, I was scared to death.
Right.
You know, I was 20 years old at the time. You know, and I didn't know what I was doing. So at that time, I had no idea. So you had to sell bigger. You had to kind of you know, put your arms out, like, you know, like almost like Ricky used to do, Steamboat yeah. used to do. He almost, you know, really dramatized everything he did because your face really wasn't available to tell that story, that pain.
Right.
You know, and I also used my vocals because I didn't have long hair. Like Shawn Michaels used to have that wonderful snap sell when he got punched or whatever, you know, and I didn't have that, so sometimes, you know, I'd do a Dickie Murdoch and hawk a big loogie to try to, you know, show some impact.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying, though? You know, it's just anything to accentuate what's being done to me. So it was definitely different.
Well, so what was the inspiration behind the Pro Wrestling 101 videos? How did you come up with this concept and decide to proceed forward with this? Because I've enjoyed the ones that I've watched. And to any of those people, and I always get people who send me emails to questions at steveaustinshow.com. If you have any questions, I answer the ones that I can. But if you go to YouTube and you go, if you just Google in or type in the search engine Pro Wrestling 101, up will come all of the videos done by Justin Credible. And again, if you want to learn something or if you have some questions, a lot of these things will be answered on YouTube by Justin Credible. So I highly suggest you get on there and check them out.
I just basically thought, you know, how could, you know, I'm not on TV. I haven't been on TV at a national level since 2010. I did some TNA stuff. Before that, I was in WWE in 2006 for the relaunch of ECW. But that was it. And with social media, I'm like, it's my responsibility to, you know, I could stay relevant somewhat, you know, stay with, you know, the dirt sheets could say, hey, Justin's got a new video out, or, you know, just something to get people talking, to have my name, face, and then say something hopefully relevant to this day and age. And I just figured, you know, if young kids, because I'm on the indies, that's how I make my living now, if young kids could take a shortcut by listening to the things that I'm just saying what was said to me. I didn't come up with this stuff. This was stuff I learned through 22 years of and being in the ring, of listening to guys like you, guys like, you know, Shawn Michaels, Sean Wolf, and Scott Hall, whoever, you know, Hunter. You know, this is all stuff that I had heard and was told to me that I'm just relaying back out there. So if people really wanted to, you know, it's stuff that you and I didn't have. We had to kind of go out there and school the hard knocks and learn it on our own, you know. And it's just, you know, hopefully it works, and hopefully people, you know, remember me and keep tuning in, you know.
Well, I mean, what I like about them, I talk a lot about the business on my podcast, and I don't necessarily talk about all of the nuances or all the insider things. And I think you do a very good job of kind of protecting the business a little bit, but very open with the business. It's not an exact secret anymore, but you know, some things are better left unsaid. And you're
absolutely
still currently on the independent circuit, correct?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
And on Twitter, you are at PJ Polacco, P-O-L-A-C-O. How else can people get a hold of you for bookings, appearances, and so forth, Justin?
Well, I have my website, which is pretty much a one-stop shopping. It has the Pro Wrestling 101's Facebook, Twitter. It's called www.thejustincredible.com, and you know, everything there, you can get a hold of me. I got my blogs, my videos, Twitter, Facebook, everything.
Well, I'm coming right back. We're going to take a commercial break. We're going to pick the story back up with PJ Polacco, Justin Credible, Aldo Montoya, after a word from my sponsors. We're going to talk a little bit more about PJ as he leaves WWE, goes into ECW, gets tangled up with a few problems, comes out on the bright side, and more of his story when we come back from this break for my sponsors.
You're listening to another classic episode of The Steve Austin Show, only on Podcast One.
Hey man, do you own or rent your home? Sure you do, and I bet it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling policies with GEICO. GEICO makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to GEICO.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's GEICO easy. Visit GEICO.com today. That's GEICO.com.
All right, here I am back here with PJ Polacco. We're talking about Pro Wrestling 101. His tidbits of information that you can find on YouTube that I highly recommend. Those of you that have questions, go check his videos out. I have thoroughly enjoyed them. Hey, PJ, the waters there in WWF back in the day, you hooked up with the Click. You got to run pretty strong with those guys. And so that was basically, is that who you're running up and down the road with at the time?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't even so much the Click as it
right.
was it's Scott Hall, because, you know, when I first came in the business, I couldn't even rent a car. And Scott was always very, very cool to me. He was very, you know, he always liked hanging around younger guys, made him feel, you know, kind of like, look, you know, I'm a little older. Like, what could you guys teach me? What's going on in society? That was always his shtick. And I was like, hey, you know, Scott was one of the best in the business, you know? And I was like, dude, I'll, please, you know, tell me, I'll do whatever you want. I'll carry your bags. Just, you know, give me your knowledge and now you're, you know what I'm saying? So yeah, it was an opportunity for me to learn, so it was awesome.
Dude, that guy was one. Every now and then I'll throw down a phone call to Scott Hall, and sometimes I might talk to him for just 5 or 10, 15, 20 minutes, and we'll just start going off, obviously, about the business of pro wrestling. He'll start dropping some information on me, and we'll be talking about psychology 101, 201. We might get to the 301 level, but, man, that guy, he sees things from a lot of the same perspective as I do, but all, you know, has his take, you know, coming out of you know, the journey that he's been on. He's, to me, he's one of the brightest cats I've ever met in the business.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and
so what kind of knowledge did he bestow upon you?
It was just basic. You know, I would hear, and this was the time of the famous Sean and Razor ladder match. You know, I'd be in the cars listening to Razor and Sean coming out of the garden, and, you know, hey, this worked. This is, you know, listening to the people. Why? I mean, I didn't say much, but you were just hearing the whys and wheres and whens, and like, this didn't work, maybe this will. And, you know, just a lot of positive stuff that you can't really, you can't buy that information, you know what I mean? And it was just, you're learning from the best. I was always into, like, self-help stuff, and I read a book that said the quickest way for athletes or anybody to get ahead in life is to role model successful people and not copy what they do, but take their approach and work ethic and psychology and kind of, you know, follow their lead. And that's always what I kind of wanted to do. I was like, well, these guys are on top of the business kind of right now. I was like, you know, if I could just get a quarter of what they had, I'd be in good shape. And that was always kind of what I just wanted to be a sponge, you know.
You know, it's funny, PJ, when I first got into WWF, you know, they brought me in as a ringmaster. That didn't work so great. And then it came up with Stone Cold gimmick, and we started running that. Well, you and I were working a lot of matches. We worked on TV. We were working on the house shows. At one point, you remember when Jake the Snake Roberts took you on as his protege, and he was managing you? We're going to get to that story in a minute because I know what you're laughing about. But, you know, I had a chance to cut a couple of promos on you back in the day. You know, I said, you know, you didn't have any business being in the same ring as I did. And I talked about the jock strap, you know, the mask that was on your face. I mean, that was just perfect material for me. And that was a lot of the stuff that because you remember back then, we would film a live show and then the next one would be to tape because we were filming live every other week because the territory was down and it was too expensive to go live every week. But when those tapes went back to post, they were editing my lines out. And I saw Vince McMahon walking to one of the buildings. I guess it was Lowell, Massachusetts or whatever it was. And I barely knew Vince at the time, although I'd been in the company for 8 or 9 months. And you know how it is. You don't really hang out with the boss.
Yeah.
And I just had the guts to say, hey, Vince, can I talk to you for a second? Well, sure, pal. And I told him, I said, hey, man, I noticed a lot of times when I'm watching the show, you guys are editing out some of the things that I'm saying. And he goes, well, Steve, quite frankly, you're popping the guys in the truck. And a lot of that stuff was the material that I was directing towards you. And you know, PJ,
right,
if you can pop the guys in the truck who have seen and heard everything, then you can pop the world. So I told Vince, and I said, hey, Vince, I said, I'll tell you what. I said, I'm 6'2", 250. I got, you know, a bald head, a goatee, black trunks, black boots. I said, you get guys here 6'8", 7 feet tall, 300, 320 pounds. I said, if you take my personality from me, I cannot compete. But if you give me my personality, I can. He goes, well, okay. Well, that's fine. So then he stopped editing my lines. The Stone Cold Steve Austin thing took off, and it ended up being what it ended up being. It had a hell of a run. But a lot of that was due to the fact that I was working with you. As all the things have seemingly lined up for me, as, you know, Sean and Triple H and Razor, you know, the big hug in the garden. Triple H was going to win 1996 King of the Ring. I was Plan B.
Yep.
Had it not been for you, I would have not got to run my mouth in the fashion that I did. And so I got to give you credit for some of the, you know, the success that I had, the fact that I was wrestling with you, and we gave credence for me to cut those promos. I want to go to one time, remember this, We were working, you and me were working a bunch of shots together. You were Jake's protege, and we were working some of those tent towns. And yes. To my listeners, the tent towns, how would you describe the tent towns, PJ? They were just smaller towns, and we were working about, what, a 16-foot ring?
Yeah. We had to do the only way you could do anything, kind of any kind of big move like a vertical suplex, was corner to corner. You didn't have enough any other way, kind of, you know.
And the thing about these,
they were musical tents. That's what they were. They were old school musical tents that they ran once a year, always in the summer around the Cape Cod, Hyannis Port area.
That's and it was all were. One That's level. Right. It was just all steel chairs, all one level seating, and there was a little rope keeping the people from the ring. It was a 16-foot ring. Now, normally, WWF uses a 20-foot ring. That's what they still use to this day. And you know, have you worked in a WCW ring, an 18-footer?
I did, once or twice.
They're okay. I mean, okay when you get used to them, but once you get that 20-foot ring, when you have that much more space, at first it blows you up and it kind of messes your timing up. But once you get used to it, you don't want to be in anything but that. But here we are in these tent towns, 16-footers. The thing that I loved about a 16-footer, there's no way you could blow up. If you blew up in a 16-foot ring, there's a big damn problem because you're out of shape. So anyway, there we are. And the thing about this, and I know you remember this, those rings had that crazy loud sound to them every time you took them. It just kind of just sounded like it sounded like the person that was getting the bump was just getting killed. And so there was a spring in there. I was working heel. You were working baby. And there's Jake Roberts, your manager. And I gave you a string of suplexes. Now, they were all not in rapid succession, but how many times did I suplex you that day?
There was in the good double digits. I'd like to remember around 14.
Yeah, it was.
14, I mean, they were up there.
It was between 14 and 15 suplexes, and I'd take my time between them, and every time I'd look over at Jake and I'd point at Jake and I said, this one's for you. And Jake was feeling your pain. He goes, no, don't do it. He's begging me not to suplex you. And of course, I'd suplex you, and you'd do that big Ricky Steamboat archback sell.
It was,
and we were laughing our asses off in a ring. Between ourselves, but we had some great times working in some of those towns.
Yeah, we really did, man.
So what was your ultimate first departure from WWF for?
At that time, man, when it hit around 97, I was 23 years old. Money wasn't that great. I mean, I was doing okay. I mean, today I would, believe me, today I would kill for it. But back then, it's like, okay, I'm 23. I've had a little bit of time under my belt. I felt like I was coming into my own as a performer. I knew Aldo was never going to go anywhere. I mean, I was still being booked. I was making a living. But I just wanted
to. But you could see that gimmick was going to go nowhere, like I could see the ringmaster gimmick. Yeah.
Right, absolutely. And I felt, the business was starting to change. The NWO was starting to happen. Kevin and Scott went over there. And it was just like, when you started, you started changing it on that end as well. It was just more reality-based, more. Just a different thing was going on, and you felt it, And I told Vince I actually had guts to go over and schedule a meeting with Vince in Stamford. I went in there. I said, Vince, I'd like to do something else. I said, if you don't have anything kind of for me, I'd like my release, if I can't do something. And he goes, no, you've been here for a little while. We'll send you to Memphis to learn how to work as a heel to the USWA.
Right.
Jerry Lawler's thing down there. Because we didn't have a developmental at the time. Because I had never been a heel, to be honest. And so, okay, I said, fine, I'll take it. But the pay, I just had gotten married maybe 5-6 weeks prior to this meeting with Vince. And the WWE was only compensating me $500 at the time to basically have my home in Connecticut and to go down to Memphis, because in Memphis you made $40 a night.
Right.
And, I did it with, I was cool with it for a minute, but I saw that being a dead end.
Yes.
I knew that nothing was, I would be down in the USWA for however long, and I wasn't learning anything. I mean, I was working with Lawler, but I'd worked with Lawler already.
Right.
Up in New York and stuff, so I wasn't really. So at the time, what really was the catalyst was USWA had a feud with ECW, with a couple of ECW guys, because Lawler had done something at the ECW arena, and Candido was there with Heyman, Sabu, and Van Damme, and I was friends with Chris from the Body Donna days, the Skip and Tom Pritchard deal. And I said, look, Chris, you know, what's going on, man? It looks like you guys got some really good things going on. And he goes, yeah, I'm pretty close with Paul. Let me see what I can do. And Paul talked to Vince, said, hey, look, you won't, you know, because I'm sure Scott and Kevin at the time could have probably got me a something going on down there. Not to say that I would have made a big star out of myself, probably not. But, you know, I probably could have got a little payday from it. But it worked out that I, you know, Vince allowed me to go to ECW. And, you know, to be honest, it was the best thing that could have ever happened to me.
But the bottom line was he was going to allow you to go to ECW as long as you didn't go to WCW, who, you know, they were luring a lot of the talent away from WWF. So no can do on that, but you can go to ECW. And, you know, and to my listeners out there, I mean, for a guy who's 23 years old, he's not getting, enough ring time or enough camera time that he feels that he needs to make a move to walk into the man's office, Vince McMahon, and especially back then or even today, and say, hey, man, if you ain't got nothing for me, man, how about my release? That takes a lot of balls, and that takes a lot of foresight, and that takes some determination to not be satisfied with the status quo and to maybe know that there's not a bright future ahead for you. So that was a hellacious move on your part. I got to give you a lot of credit for that.
Look, I never said I was going to make it. I didn't know, but I was going to go out trying. I love this business. I still do.
But they didn't maybe have, you know, the design or the plans for you to be that guy, and you saw that.
Sure.
And look for another place to go just so you could ply your trade, have a little bit more freedom and a little bit more frequency.
Absolutely.
So you run in, here you come into ECW. How did you guys come up with the Just Incredible thing?
You know, at the time, Paul just had me come in, and I didn't have it all happened very quickly. And, you know, he just said, look, we got a show in Queens, New York, and a show in Philadelphia. Just come down. I said, well, Paul, I don't have any gear, you know, other than the Aldo stuff. He said, don't worry about it. So the first night in Queens, I actually wrestled Chris Candido as Aldo. And I cut a promo. I don't know. I'd love to see if this was somewhere because I'd never seen it. But I tell you, I cut a promo, threw the mask into the crowd, whatever. I, you know, cussed out the WWF at the time. And I had a match, put Chris over. The next night, we had a show at the ECW Arena. And I guess Paul, one of his guys, I think it was a ring crew guy, Bill Wiles, saw a bumper sticker on the back of a pickup truck that said Just Incredible.
Right.
And he pitched this to Heyman, but Heyman said, you know, I don't see this as you to Bill Wiles. And he said, but I got, you know, so I guess they hashed it out. Paul actually gave him a couple bucks for the name. And then Paul then gave the name to me. And the reason I started doing the jean shorts and the old, you know, basically the ECW uniform was I didn't have any gear. I just had the Aldo stuff because the timing didn't permit, you know. And it just ended up, look, here's an ECW t-shirt. Back in the 90s, you know, you remember that you wore the jean shorts.
Yeah.
I still do it too. And that's what I had in my bag. I had the high techs because that's what we wore.
Yep.
Threw my pads on and I'm just incredible. Let's go. And I worked with Jerry Lynn that night. Paul put me over and, you know, it led to a hell of a run, man.
Hey, man, so, you know, the ECW atmosphere, ECW arena, it was a very interesting dynamic. And a lot of things going on backstage. You ultimately ended up having a few issues with a few substances. Now,
yes.
Were you – you obviously weren't at rock bottom yet, but were you on your way to being there, running up and down the road – and using pain pills, somas, muscle relaxers, all that BS?
Believe it or not, it started to get bad towards the end of ECW.
Okay.
The frequency, and it mostly started, I mean, I messed around with a lot of things recreationally, but the problem became with the pain pills, the hydrocodone, the oxycodone, and during that time I got introduced to, you know, Oxycontin, which was, you know, basically prescription-grade heroin.
That's kind of, the Mac Daddy, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, but I didn't really, I was so naive, Steve. When ECW went out of business, you know, and I left. I did the last ECW pay-per-view. I had a good relationship with Jim Ross. I emailed Jim Ross. This is 2001, early 2001. And he gave me a nice not a six-figure deal, but a six-figure deal nonetheless, to team with Waltman over there in WWE. But before then, and there's a reason I'm telling you this about the substances, before I started with the WWE after ECW went out of business, we went on a vacation, my wife and I and my newborn son, And, you know, she said, my wife says to me, hey, honey, do you need a refill? You're all out of your meds, you know, like innocently enough. And I was like, well, honey, I'm not wrestling for a little while. I don't need them. You know, we'll just go on vacation. Don't worry about it. You know, I'm not going to take any bumps, whatever. Brother, that was the most miserable, you know, I didn't understand. You know, I got there, you know, started to have the sweats, couldn't sleep. Vomiting, diarrhea, just restless.
So you're having withdrawals and you didn't really even know you were hooked.
Didn't know it. No, I was so naive because it started off, because, I mean, you remember the Wild West days. I mean, things were just, you know, it was just a different era than it is today. And I was just doing things a lot of times to fit in. And then, of course, I started to enjoy it because, hey, it does feel, people aren't drug addicts because it's bad. It feels good at first.
Right.
I didn't get the physical, again, my naive nature, you know, I was like, you know, and then I finally, towards the end of the vacation, it was only a 3-day vacation, I called my doctor, I said, doc, I don't know what's wrong with me. I explained to him, and he said, don't worry about it, I'll call you in something. Called me in some Vicodin, go to the pharmacy, pick it up. I was like, oh, that's what physical addiction, then I understood, I'm like, I'm normal now.
Right.
I just took pills to be normal, and I was like, oh, that's what it is. You know, and it was very naive of me. I mean, telling you the story, it's almost embarrassing, but I was that naive or that caught up in the lifestyle of being, you know, living my dream and not thinking about repercussions or whatever. But that's how it was, man. And that's when I realized I had a serious problem.
So how serious did it get? I mean, so you're on the pain pills, the Oxycontin. Did it graduate to a heavier duty stuff than that?
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, things didn't. I was a functioning addict,
right,
for very much of my, my next run with X Factor, where I teamed with Pac and Albert. We had that little trio thing,
yep,
there, and then you know, the Alliance happened. So Pac went his way. I went to the ECW, WCW Alliance, which you were part of as well. You led that deal. And, you know, and then I was just, it really started to deteriorate. But until, you know, God rest his soul, Benoit, the thing happened, you know, with him and his family, where everybody started to really crack down.
Right.
And doctors were cutting people off left and right, where then I became, you know, I'd lost my job, actually, at that point. I was working with the newly found TNA when they first started doing TV tapings on pay-per-views on every Tuesday or something like that. But anyways, when that happened is when I had to start getting them off, you know, friends, neighbors, off the street, basically. And then when I lost work and couldn't afford, you know, $40, $50 per pill, Steve, is when I went to, you know, somebody one day said, hey, man, you know, if you snort a bag of heroin, it's just like, you know, Oxycontin. I said, well, okay, I was very sick. I couldn't afford it, and it was cheaper, like way cheaper. So I started doing that, and then, of course, it became about finances because I blew through all, you know, I never made $1 million, but I made a living, but I blew through whatever I had, and then it was like, well, I can only get a bag or two of heroin so I'm not sick, but if I snort it, I won't feel it because now my tolerance is up. Well, then somebody said, hey, I'll inject you. So I became an IV heroin user, you know, for a couple of years, man, 3-4 years.
Dude, take me through this, man, it's snorting heroin. I mean, I've never messed with heroin in my life. So I've heard of people snorting it. Does snorting is it a different high or a different feeling than injecting it?
No.
Does the injection last longer? Is it more intense?
No, it was, you know, it's like, I guess it's like, you know, I didn't really care at the point either. I guess I was just, for example, if snorting 3 bags of heroin would get me well, because a lot of the stuff, I mean, Oxycontins are technically stronger because it's pharmaceutical grade. I mean, when
right.
you're doing street drugs, you're getting a lot of garbage.
Right.
A lot of times, you're not, you know, you don't know what you're getting, put it that way. So if you snorted 3 bags, for example, but if you injected 1, you're going right to the source. It's
right.
not that it's different or better. It's just, it again became about, I'm broke. I need my fix. I don't have the money. So it's just, what could I do to not be sick? And you know what I mean? It becomes very sad. I mean, it's actually, I mean, I don't pity myself. I made my own problems. Whatever.
No, but you come out of it as we're about to hear. You make a comeback and kick it. But so if there's 7 days in a week, how many of those days in a week do you have to shoot up when you're a heroin addict?
Oh, you have to shoot up every 12 hours. at least, yeah. And you're not even high. You're just trying to get well, you know. Absolutely, yeah, every 12 hours. I mean, I blew fortunes. I've stolen from my family. I've been as low as low can go. I mean, except I'm amazed my wife stuck by me and my kids are still with me.
Well, what was what was the dynamic in the house then, man? I mean, she knows, right? I mean, where were you shooting? Because, I mean, do you have track marks on your arms or were you shooting?
I was a mess. I was shooting in my arms. Yeah, absolutely.
So obviously she knows. I mean, what's she trying to do? Convince you to go to rehab? Hey, I'm going to leave you.
No, you know, it was, you know, a lot of codependency stuff at the time, you know, and I'm okay with talking about it, you know, cause she had taken pain pills as well, you know? And, so it was, you know, she didn't want to demonize me too much because she understood what being sick was. And she knew that I had to go out and make a living. So for a lot of years, I justified it. It wasn't,
right.
You know, I could convince myself, hey, dude, I need this, you know, I need this, Ma, you know, I need this to work. And of course, it's a bunch of BS, but in, you know.
Well, there's some credence to it, though. I mean, I remember back in the day, you know, when I think I'd been out of business for a couple of years and I had to come to Jesus meeting. I never really got strung out on any pills. I wasn't that guy. I like to drink. But, you know,
right.
I remember, you know, it was taking me several Ambien or Xanax or whatever to go to sleep. And I remember waking up one day and I just said, hey, man, you know what? It's one thing when you're on the road and you're using this as a tool, and I'm not justifying it. And all I got all my stuff through a doctor, but the amount I was taking wasn't as high as some of the guys that I've heard. But nonetheless,
right.
I woke up and said, hey, man, you know, this is not conducive to a long lifestyle, and just weaned myself off.
Right.
But yeah, as a tool on the road, it's one thing, to only a certain level. Then you go beyond that level, then you are abusing. I had to rein myself in. I couldn't justify it anymore and said, hey, time to knock this stuff off. So how low did you go? And then how did you end up ultimately kicking the habit? Because from everything that I've heard, heroin is just like the madman, and it's almost impossible to break away from.
It is. Basically, I was, you know, of course, when you get to that level, there's a lot of shame. You know, my kids are, you know, shame, guilt, and, you know, I knew I had a problem, and I would try to not, you know, I knew the WWE had the wellness policy where they would put guys through treatment, you know, and by the time I realized where I'd gotten, man, it was way too late. But I was so shameful, so embarrassed, Steve, that I didn't want to admit it to anybody outside of my immediate family. It was very embarrassing. And one time, I don't remember the date anymore, but I think it was like 2010 or 11. It was one of those ECW reunion shows. Basically, man, I got a bunch of dope and I shot it up and I passed out with no condition to perform.
Right.
That, you know, that thing that they say, you know, the dirt sheets, you know. Well, I was that. There was some, you know, the boy, the difference between the boys of today and of yesterday, one of the boys in the locker room took a picture of me passed out and put it all over social media.
Right.
So it was a career killer, you know, nobody, you know. It was affecting my business. It was affecting my family, my relationships. No, you know, couldn't. It was very hard to get bookings, and it was, of course, you know, who wants to take that? And now, you know, there's this stuff out there where I'm passed out. So it took, you know, I tried to do it the hard way, couldn't do it. Tried to white knuckle it, like tough it out. You know, so locked myself in rooms with a bucket, basically throwing up everything coming out of every end. You know, and I would always go back, you know, just for the relief, you know, just for, I can't take it. Eventually, man, you know, November of 2012, I mean, it was a long time coming. I had gone to one rehab center without the WWE's help, and I didn't last. But finally, I just, you know, things had gotten to the point where, you know, I think my age had a lot to do with it because I was creeping up on 40 years old now. But I was like 38, 37, 38. Like, I was like, look, am I going to throw my entire life and career away for this? I said, now, you know, when you're 45, 50, you'll have nothing but regret. And there's nothing worse than regret because you can't hop in a time machine and say, I wish it would.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So I said, I got to do this now. So I called a wonderful gentleman that they have over there called Bob Keelhart. He's actually an addiction specialist, but he's an independent guy. He doesn't work for the office, but he's used by the office. And I spoke to him, and he got me in a great place. And, you know, I just, I did everything. For once in my life, I wasn't, because we all think, a lot of us, not everybody, but a lot of us think, oh, we know better. I'll do it my way. Maybe I'll do this part of the treatment, but I don't like this other part. I just kind of went all in and said, look, I don't know anything. I'll just do what I'm told. And, you know, I got out of treatment right before Christmas of 2012. I did 90 consecutive AA, NA meetings in 90 days, got a sponsor, and just started trying to put it all together.
Well, how long were you in the facility itself?
30 days. 30 days.
So what's the program here? I mean, is it they giving you a little bit of methadone or whatever the drug of
they have a new drug now called, so what's not new anymore, maybe 10 years old.
Right.
It's called Suboxone.
Okay.
Buprenorphine. And you take that for 7 days, and it
okay,
really.
Okay. Now, when you take that, is that a pill, or are you injecting?
No. It's a strip. They give you a troubling wool that the people at the facility would wean you off with, and they'd give you other things for the sweats and
gotcha.
You know, like ibuprofen for the pain and stuff. But it was still the first 12-13 days was really. Even though it did ease it and do an incredible job, you're still not. You're used to feeling good all the time, you know. Like
right.
You're used to, you know, you want that instant relief, and I had to get used to feeling pain. Like I always, a lot of times, I was so down because I put so much stake in pro wrestling. Again, I'm not blaming this business, but I loved it so much, and I saw my life kind of my opportunities being squandered. I was like, man, what do I have, anyways? I didn't care.
Right.
And I was just so miserable, so I would keep masking. I didn't want to know. So I got to get used to feeling again and knowing what my feelings were. You know, we're tough guys. We don't like to talk about feelings. But I had to understand what my MO was, whatever, with my
right.
family, my kids, my wife. And I got that all under control. And, I mean, I still go to meetings, you know, once a week. And I still, you know, do my work.
But
yeah,
is it
to kind of...
So how long now have you been clean?
1 year and 7 months.
Man, I used to when I used to hang around Brian Pillman before he passed, you know, he would always tell me, he goes, Steve, and he'd have that smile on his face. He goes, alcohol and drugs are patient. They wait for you. So do you still have the urge? Do you ever hear that heroin calling you back? Are you able to give it the stiff arm, or it's just not a part of your life anymore?
It's not a part of my life anymore. But the reason it wasn't, the first 2-3 months was the hardest.
Right.
And I just kind of, you know, alcoholism is, I think, in my opinion, the hardest. See, I never really dug alcohol. I was more into
substance. No, I remember that.
And I just never, remember, you know what I'm saying? I never really, whatever, the buzzes were different. But for me, I think alcoholism is harder because you can go to any store legally and get it. But for me, I got home, I threw my phone out. I said, I cleared everything out, you know, all the dealers and stuff. And, you know, and it's not like, because back in the, you know, when the way I got it was, I didn't go have to cop in the hood. You know, nowadays, the day of cell phones, I'd call my boy up, he'd be here in 15, 20 minutes, as long as
right.
I had the money.
Right.
He was at my, you know, drive through, come up to you. I just got rid of all that stuff. I had a support group, and now I'm so far removed that it's not there. I have more problems now with casually, maybe, you know, if I see somebody drinking a beer.
Right.
Like, man, after a show, it'd be nice to have a cold beer.
Yep.
And to be honest, I'm not saying it would be the death of me. I just don't want to, you know, I'm not.
You don't need to find out. You might have that.
You're right. That's
just,
what I'm saying. Yeah. I don't need to find out. You know, I wouldn't go like buck wild, but I don't want to test it. I've done enough damage. I'm cool right now. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, because
so,
you got away from the needle, but that alcohol might offer something that's kind of in that same vein. And that just that first beer could lead to, you know, an ongoing process
right.
where it just blows up
yes,
on
sir.
You. And there you are, stone cold alcoholic. You don't want that.
Yes,
I'm
sir.
Sitting here talking
yes,
to just incredible PJ Polacco. He got a bad ride, got on some heroin. We're just going to take a little break. We're going to finish up talking about this and talk about what he's currently doing on the independent scene. And again, the type of workers he's meeting out on the road, what kind of talent there is out there. Taking a break right now. Word from our sponsors who keep this show on the air for free for you to download twice a week. PJ Polacco, just incredible. When we come back,
You're listening to another classic episode of The Steve Austin Show, only on Podcast One.
Pluto TV is playing the biggest movies every night this summer for free. Watch hit movies like The Hunger Games, The Matrix, Pain and Gain, G.I. Joe Retaliation, Scary Movie, Runaway Bride, and more all summer long. Check out the biggest stars like The Rock, Keanu Reeves, Jennifer Lawrence, Tom Cruise, Julia Roberts, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and more. Plus, Pluto TV has hundreds of free TV channels in English and Spanish featuring TV shows, news, sports, comedy, and more all for free. Download the free Pluto TV app on your favorite streaming device, including Android and Apple smartphones. Pluto TV. Drop in. Watch free.
All right, everybody. Coming back here, sitting here talking to just incredible PJ Polacco, talking about getting off air when all the bad stuff. Let's continue down that road just a little further, Justin. So in the locker room these days, I would, you know, probably guess that there's still a lot of elements still out there. So how is, you know, your ability to say, can I have a Vicodin? Can I have this? Can I have that? Hey, man, you got an extra one of these. How do you keep yourself from doing that?
I think the business culture has changed a little bit than the way it was before. But, I just try not to add, you know, if there's somebody, you know, and what I encounter mostly is still is, you know, you have a guy with a 12-pack, you know, right. And a lot of people like to get together, you know, in the back and smoke, you know, a joint or whatever. You know, that's more in my face. And, it's not an educated thing. I just have to, you know, sometimes it's just out of pure shame that I won't do it. If that's what gets me through, that works for me, or, whatever. I mean, every time it's different. I've had to call sponsors when I'm at shows, if I'm feeling a little trigger happy or just not too long ago, man, I was at one of, I don't know if you've ever heard of Dragon Gate USA, but yeah. We did a show down with Gabe Sapolsky in New York, and, I was outside. I smoke cigarettes still, so, you know, I'll smoke a cigarette, whatever, just outside, and some young kids come up to me, like, hey, Justin, whatever, nice to meet you, man. You know, you want to smoke a joint? And I was like, wow, because that hadn't happened.
Right.
Believe it or not, that hadn't happened. And I didn't know how to, you know, and I thought about it, and there were some people there, and I was like, nah, dude, I'm cool. And one of the kids there, this will really open my eyes, he said, you know what, Justin, I always thought, you know, people say they're sober, but they're not really sober. You know, I see that what you just did, that's cool. So it's like, sometimes, man, sometimes it's that. Sometimes it's not just self-destructing. Sometimes it's whatever little thing gets me to do the right next right thing kind of is where I go. And, it's just, it's a daily thing. Like, I don't know where I'm going to be tomorrow. You know, all I can say is, like, right now I'm cool. I feel good, you know, and every day. Sometimes I don't think about it for, a couple of weeks. Sometimes, you know, longer. Depends where life takes you. You have certain situations. Things pop up. I've had guys, man, this happened in the very beginning, where I used to test the stuff for one of these guys, one of the dealers. Jesus. And he came over to my house with a free batch for me to test. You know, talk about really, I was fresh out of the deal at this point. I said, brother, I can't. I said, I just went through this thing. I said, please, if you respect your care, you know, at all, please don't ever do that again and don't come here anymore. And, you know, but if it was a bad day, I don't know where that would have led, you know. So it sounds cliche. I hate doing the cliche taglines because that's not my style, but it is like a one day at a time deal. You know.
Dude, it takes a pretty good low life to call up somebody and say, hey, man, I need you to test this stuff. How about it?
I know.
Especially knowing where you're trying to be. I mean, and you're going to be the guinea pig. And obviously you were a guinea pig for some time. But Jesus Christ, that's
it is. But I'm just being real, you know. But
no, I hear you. Thing,
you know, but back in the day when I was sick from not having it, boy, I would have welcomed that call in a minute because I didn't have enough money to get it
You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
So it was like that, you know, it was a lot of confusion, a lot of craziness, brother.
Hey, dude.
A lot of craziness.
You're 40 years old. As far as human beings go, you're still extremely young. As far as being in the business goes, you know, prime, you know, depending on where you're at. But you've been in the business for 20 years. How's your body feeling after all the bumps? Because you've done a lot of stuff, a lot of high-flying stuff, a lot of stuff off the top turnbuckle. How's the carcass holding up? Any major surgeries?
No, none at all, actually. I've been blessed. I've never had knee surgeries, never had shoulders. The worst thing for me was that it's gotten worse with age, has been I've had a lot of concussions, you know. So that's always been a little bit of a, you know, I won't take big bumps, like big power bombs or whatever, if I could avoid it, no. You know, but, I just try to command what I could take now, and on the indies I can, you know, yeah. People, the young kids are pretty respectful. I say, hey, look, I could do this, I could do that. I could still move really well. I'm blessed, man. I've had a blessed life. I shouldn't be where I am today in the shape that I am today with what I've done.
Where have most of your concussions come from, PJ? Because, you know, I think I've taken maybe a couple of stiff chair shots, but I was always the guy that put his hands up because I believe in that. I'm gonna absorb it. And maybe I took a bad bump or two, but I cannot say I had a concussion heavy career like so many more guys are just coming out of the woodwork. Yeah, I had 6, 7, 8 concussions. You got to be doing something wrong. Unless you're just a high flyer and you're taking some crash landings. So where did yours come from is my question.
It wasn't I was a firm believer in the hands up too. I never took the straight chair shots. I just couldn't. I started getting them very early. Actually, my first concussion is very well documented. I was working with the head shrinkers, Samu and Fatu, in 93. And, remember, man, back in those days, man, they would just brutalize you. I was a jobber, whatever. And they kind of took their liberties with me. And, live Monday Night Raw at the Manhattan Center, they knocked me out cold. They literally had to take my dead carcass and tag my partner in and bring him in and finish him off. And I finished, I drove home from Manhattan to Connecticut, woke up in my bed not knowing how I got here. And since then, you take a bad bump where maybe you don't tuck your chin, you whiplash, I was very, just stuff like that. It was, and I guess I also became a little more gun shy. So, how it is when you overprotect, then you become even more susceptible to that injury. If you're putting your elbows down like the Flair deal, or sometimes you would, be reaching, you start doing that, then that's when you get hurt instead of just taking a flat bump like you would. So, other than that, man, I've been pretty blessed, and it doesn't affect me today. So, I just got to be careful with what I do.
Hey, man, talking about concussions, let me give since PJ does these little short videos, some instructional videos on YouTube called Pro Wrestling 101, and they're outstanding. Let me offer a little tidbit of advice for some of you guys that are just coming up in the business or on the indie scene, trying to get noticed or make a name for yourself. If you're afraid of a bump, if you're unsure of a bump, if you're unsure of your opponent safely giving you this bump, refuse to take it. Be respectful and don't take the bump. Don't put yourself in harm's way for no reason or for $20 or $40 or even $100. It ain't worth it. So if there's a bump that you're intimidated by and you do not think you can safely take it or it can be delivered to you, refuse to take it. And say, I'm sorry, but I can't do that bump. And if the person who wants to give you the bump doesn't understand, well, then it is what it is. But you got to protect yourself in the business, and I think you would agree with that, PJ.
Oh, absolutely. And I actually remember what you're saying came true to me. When I went back, I was working with me and Pac versus Crash Holly and Bob Holly. And Bob, bless his heart, I always got along with him. We had good matches. But he used to do that big Alabama slam deal.
Yeah.
And I said he wanted to do that to me. And then he wanted me to kick out. I said, Bob, I've known you since the Aldo and Sparky Plug days. I said, I'll take it with all due respect, but I might not kick out. And I said, I'll do anything, I'll do something else.
Yeah.
And Bob was cool with it, man. He was like, oh, Peach, that's cool. It's the way you approach it. I've always tried to be just as sincere as I can. And, most of the times, if you have some tenure or even if you approach people right man to man, I think it's, they'll oblige. Nobody wants to hurt anybody, I would hope.
Hey, let's talk about the indie scene right now, PJ. That's where you're actually making a living. Where are most of your bookings coming from, and what kind of talent is out there? As far as, when I look at the WWE product as a whole, it's very green. It's a new generation coming in, and they have some outstanding cats in there with so much potential. But just the fact that a lot of veterans have faded off into the sunset. So on the independent scene, how accomplished are those people in the ring? And do you see any standouts out there? What's the quality of workers out there?
You see, this is where it gets weird for me. I think the quality of the athlete, Steve, is better than ever because these guys, they don't. It wasn't like it was when we were coming up. They will go to their rooms and, you know, they'll eat well, they'll train, they won't be out, you know, hanging out, having a good time, whatever. They take it very seriously. They're in good physical shape. But I think people have, you know, I was one of the, you know, I talked about this with Waltman the other day. I saw him at a convention. There's few of us that came through the last of the territory systems. I got a chance to really learn to sell and to you know, people, if you could only, JR said something about this in one of his podcasts, and it made so much sense. Guys in Ring of Honor and others, and that's, I mostly work in the Northeast and, you know, the Philly area and stuff like that. But, man, people, if they would just slow down and sell a little bit. I'm not saying you don't have to do, you know, the business evolves. We all have to evolve with it if we're going to stay relevant. But, man, sometimes, you know, fans don't have enough time to cheer. Because they're just ping-ponging around.
Right.
And I mean, agreed. You know, that used to be me too, you know. But if you could just give the fans a chance to sell and digest and actually get emotion, because these guys, man, they look like they're killing themselves. I don't know how they're not killing themselves, but they're pop right up. Like, they make me not believe in it because they look like they're hurt, but then they'll nip right up and go into the next spot. Whereas if, man, sometimes you just hold on to whatever part you just got injured and sell it, and, you know, God forbid you just, you know, just to some of that, I always believed that even when the business evolves, the old school basics will always, always stand out. And, you know, you talk to NBA players, LeBron James said it the other day after one of the finals games, I think, you know, basics win games, basics in wrestling will get you success. Doesn't mean you got to stay old school, but the basics will always ring true. And if you don't know your basics, you're not going to succeed. And just take some of the old and meld it with the new, and I think that's a good thing. And I think guys will get it. I think it's just a lack of experience, a lack of know-how. And, you know, like all of us, man, when I was young, it's like, oh, we know better, you know. And I think a lot of it is lack of leadership, really. And, you know, they don't have the veteran guys out there anymore to kind of teach them the ways, you know. And that's a shame. But there's a lot of great talent. Especially Northeast, I could say, I could vouch that there's some amazing talent out here.
So how many days a week are you in the ring these days? I mean, how often are you out on the road?
Not often enough, believe it or not. I mean, I there's a gentleman in my a town or two over that has a school, and what he allows me to do is I cut him a little, you know, I get a student, go to cut him a little piece, and, you know, I go down to his school once or twice a week. I only take one guy at a time. You know, and I do him right, and you know, kick the guy with the ring a little bit of money, and I usually work Fridays and Saturdays, but sometimes only on a Saturday. You know, to be perfectly frank, and you know, because nobody, unfortunately, man, guy my level, you know, not a lot of people are willing to pay because the business has changed so much, and so many guys are out there nickel and diming themselves, guys perhaps a bigger name than myself. And it's very hard to ask for, let's say, $500 when somebody with a little bit of a bigger name is doing it for $250 or $300.
Right.
I've just gotten to the point where I can't be willing to drive, you know, 6-7 hours, you know, and then bring home $150 or whatever. You know, depends on gimmicks. You know, it's changed, and I think the boys in general have not done themselves justice with promoters. And stuff like that. But it varies from individual experience to individual experience, you know. I think the business is going to make a resurgence soon. I just don't know how or when. But I think something's coming because I think it has to.
Hey, you got the Library of Pro Wrestling 101 videos on YouTube. How often do you film these? Are you still making these things? Or are you done?
Oh, yeah.
How often do you do this? Where do you do them at? What's the creative process?
Well, basically, I had a gentleman who was a producer. It was like an intern for the WWE. He lived up in this area, still does. Basically, we come to my garage. He has all the, you know, the HD cameras. He throws a tarp up, light up the garage real well, and it looks, you know, he does the graphics and stuff. And we just basically cut maybe 10, 12 of them. You know, 5-minute deals. I have a little book, and I'll try to get an idea, and just, you know, like how you do, man. I just call it in the ring, whatever comes to my mind on that topic. You know, if I'm thinking of something in particular, I'll write that down. But I'll try to get a topic, and also I bring a camera around. If, you know, I had a couple where, like, you know, Goldust was at a show. I interviewed Dustin about his character and how you go about,
Right.
You know, just basically like the stories that kids can't get because they're not there. I was, Terry Funk did one for me. You know, Lance Storm, Razor did one by the phone and stuff. So it's, you know, just whatever little opportunity I can to kind of school these young men and women or even fans that just might be interested in learning a little more about how our business works, you know.
I got one for you. Working the crowd or sometimes classic example. I just subscribed to the WWE Network. I've been talking about this damn thing forever. You know, it came out whenever, 6 months ago. I finally subscribed to it. I got on, I rewatched the Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels 60-minute Iron Man match. If you watch that match from start to finish, I mean, there is basically maybe one or two looks to the crowd, and it's not pandering, it's not posing, they weren't primping. It might have been just an acknowledgement, but they didn't even try to work that crowd because what they were doing was working themselves in that ring. The story was in the ring. These days, whether it's TNA or WWE, the talent is so green and the product is moving so fast, everybody's looking for a reaction. And to your point a while ago, a lot of times the crowd doesn't even have enough time to react because it's bing, bang, boom. But they're trying to, it's almost like begging the crowd for a response. Well, you have to take care of the task at hand, doing something to elicit a response. Don't go to the crowd and ask for a response. You know, that's going to come later. So I think too often these days in every single match that you will see on television, the guys are looking to the crowd for acknowledgement, approval, acceptance, or a response. And they probably need to cut that, not even in half. They need to cut three quarters of those looks out. You've got to focus on the task at hand. And when it's time to go to the people, that's when they will come.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And also, man, with, you know, a lot of people talk about TNA. What would it take to right the wrong of that ship? And I just said, look, man, in my opinion, I loved wrestling most when it was a competition. Nobody wants to tune into wrestling to see bad acting. And I think if you just put lights on in the middle of the ring, I know it's a little old-fashioned, but wins and losses matter. Titles matter. And you got so many great athletes. Let them tell their story through the action in the ring.
Well, and what you're saying now is tying back into the basics still apply in anything that LeBron James was talking about as far as going to basketball, winning basketball games. The same thing applies to the game of pro wrestling, sports entertainment.
Yes, yes. And that's one of the things, Steve, the reason I believe, and maybe you could help me with this, but one of the reasons I believe I always worked in this business was I was able to have a good match with anybody. I was able to adapt. I mean, I got in there, you know, back in the day with yourself, with Hunter, with, you know, Shawn Michaels, you know, when 2001, 2002, I was Batista's first match. I got Randy Orton right out of OVW, did him around the loop, Shelton Benjamin. I was CM Punk's first match when he debuted in ECW, Vince's ECW. And people, you know, you could make a living. Not everybody's going to be a star in this business. Not everybody has got that thing, but doesn't mean you can't partake in it. And with basics and with being good at what you do by learning that stuff, you can make a living in this business and be appreciated, you know?
I was watching one of your one-on-one videos a while ago, and you were talking about exactly what you're talking about, getting guys over. And that's become a lost art or a lost spot within the roster. That class of guys, whether you want to call them job guys, enhancement guys, as you said, and I mean this with all due respect, whatever name you want to call them, just that whole class of guys no longer exists in the business. And it's a shame because you had some of the greatest teachers in the world out there that were enhancement guys, if you will, teaching young guys how to work. Put them out on the road for a month or two. And some of the best workers in the business were those guys, and they don't exist anymore. Yeah. It's a shame.
It is a shame. I mean, I get the business has changed, but man, some of those things you can't teach that at a performance center. And I mean, I dig what they're doing, man. I think
I do too. But we were talking about working in front of a live crowd on the road,
right?
And hey, man, if you're going to have this guy, whether it's your first, second, or third match, or it's on your B team, and you've got a couple of those guys out there on B team, and you've got X on top trying to draw the house, that working with that veteran in it. in a ring in front of a real crowd that paid money to go see, and then you get your hits and your misses, and sometimes you're going to have the yep. crowd, you're going to lose the crowd. Sometimes you'll never get that crowd, but that's part of the learning process and being in there with a veteran. Okay, kid, fire up a little bit. No, 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 keep selling, keep your head up.
Right.
No, come on, come on, come on. No, more heat, you know, that taking these youngsters through those paces. And again, it's sad for me to see that whole class of guys is gone.
Right. Well, just one last thing I'll say is with this experience I had with you, and I actually mentioned it in one of the 101s. I name dropped you, but it was cool because it was a real life experience. I was nervous as hell to work with you the first time, and I said, Steve, I'm working with you tonight. You know, what are we doing? Don't worry about it, kid. Kick stunner, you know, whatever. And I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? But it worked out, man. It's called listening to the people because you were starting to get that reaction, that buzz. And you couldn't tell me what you're doing because you don't know what they're doing. So you were just listening to them, and then you were acting accordingly with me. But that, you know, that little dance, that little push and pull, that tug, you know what I'm saying? That's the dance of this business.
Well, that was the fun part about it because, you know, when you don't have everything laid out, there's that creative freedom in there. Now, I can hold up my hand.
Yeah.
I can hold up my hand in front of me, and my fingers are spread out. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 things that I know are going to happen. I'm going to fill in the gaps between all those fingers with what I call on the fly. So, yeah, we're going to have our high, you know, our stuff that, you know, is going to happen, but everything else is left to reading that crowd. And the fact of, I mean, hell, say, for instance, you and me, we're going to work. Hell, man, you know what? Tonight, I'm going to work Aldo's arm. Well, and we're going to work match 6. And, well, 5 of the matches before us, they've been working the left arm. So, hell, you know what? Call on the fly. I'm going to work your neck. Going to the neck.
Yep.
Nope, lower back. You got to change that. So then, you know, everything goes out the window. You still got your 5 things that you know are going to happen. You got to finish. Boom. Call it in a ring. And with that being said, you're at ease and you're a peace of mind because you don't have to remember anything. You're listening to the crowd. That crowd helps you make your decisions.
Yeah. Yeah, and it makes it easier on you because I notice, man, when I go out there with a guy doing a million spots, I watch myself like when I worked with a Jerry Lynn or a Rob Van Dam, I would be nervous in there because I'm trying to remember. But when I worked with other guys, you know, on a high level in ECW, you know, if we were just calling it out there, I would be relaxed and I'd be doing just incredible, you know, working that character because I'm not thinking about how many ducks do I have or how many, you know what I'm saying, what's the next flippity-flop. I'm just doing me. And that's a big difference. That's the difference between money and you know, that it's sometimes it's just that little bit. That's that difference between middle and top. You know, it's a very small thing.
And what you said kind of parallels. I just started reading a book. I have a very hard time reading. I'm reading Gary Hart, Playboy Gary Hart, My Life and the Business of Pro Wrestling, whatever. And he just said, hey, man, it's great to be a great wrestler or to wrestle a great wrestler, but you know, drawing money isn't always about being a great wrestler. You know, it's about being that character, being that person, being that persona that everybody believes in. So many people get caught up in and it's great to be a great worker. Ain't no doubt about it. But you've got to have the whole package. And if you can just go out there and be a mechanic, it's one thing. But like you said, you've got to be just incredible. You've got to be stone cold. You've got to be the Undertaker. If none of the people I just mentioned weren't themselves, then it's just work. You've got to have the other factor on top of that work to have the whole package.
Absolutely, man. That makes all the difference in the world.
So what's coming up next for you?
Well, right now, man, I'm sure everybody kind of knows Billy Corgan from the Smashing Pumpkins. He's a big wrestling fan.
Absolutely.
He hooked up with a small company in Chicago called Resistance Pro. And, you know, just basically, you know, booking the towns, you know, creative guy for the company. And really exciting stuff is that they shot a pilot, which I was not a part of, but they shot a pilot. And they shopped it out to some networks, and I was out a couple weeks ago on Variety.com, the big Hollywood, industry paper or whatever, that they signed 8 weeks, 1-hour episodes of the show we're gonna start shooting it this summer, and it's gonna be like nothing else, I guess, because it's basically focusing on, you know, the struggles of wrestlers, the desire, what drives us, you know, to go out there for 40, 50 bucks a night, making those long drives, you know, the promoter that actually runs Resistance Pro had, you know, he's in the process of losing his house because he kind of put everything up, you know, for to run this promotion for this past year. So, you know, it's kind of, you know, we obviously, they got the show because of Billy's former, you know, his rock and roll star,
Smashing
you know, thing.
Pumpkins, yeah.
But, you know, it's going to be interesting. It's not going to so much focus on the in-ring stuff.
I think that's great because it's life on the road and the motivation behind the life on the road and the dues, the sacrifices, the hardships, and the highs and lows.
Yeah, it's going to be, I'm excited, I'm happy to be a part of it because that's what's been lacking in my life. It's just somewhere to be creative, you know, quite honestly, because in the indies, you're not getting that creative, you know, and it'll just give me an opportunity to do something different, something cool, and, you know, hopefully it turns out well, you know.
Well, I'm looking forward to that. When are y'all going to start filming that? Are you waiting on
We're shooting it, basically, the crew comes up to the shows, the Resistance Pro shows in Chicago. We do two shows a month. They're going to just, you know, follow the guys around, set cameras up all over the place, and just kind of see where it goes. And I guess in October is when the fall season starts. I'm not sure yet. They don't actually, there's not a name yet. It's right now it's called Billy Corgan's Untitled Wrestling Project, but they're going to, you know, tweak that name up a little bit. But, you know, it's going to, I'm not sure the day yet, but, you know, AMC's huge with The Walking Dead.
Absolutely.
So a lot of people are watching the channel. So if we could just get you know, some people to tune on over and you know, get interested in the world of pro wrestling, it'd be a win-win for everybody, you know.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that. I wish you guys all the luck in the world because it sounds interesting to me, and I'd love to talk to Billy Corgan on the show because I met him at several wrestling events. Always when we were in Chicago, he'd come to the shows. And it's interesting to hear about this, and I'm looking forward to seeing it. But, again, to everybody out there, if you want to see PJ's advice, Pro Wrestling 101 on YouTube, just put that in the search engine. And through various topics, he has some his thoughts and some very, I think, sound advice for people if you have questions. The guy's been in the business 20 years. It's good talking to you. On Twitter, he is at PJ Polacco. And, PJ, give me your website address again.
It is www.thejustincredible.com.
You heard it from the man himself. Hey, man, PJ, it was good talking to you. It's good to catch up to you again. And again, like I said, way back in the day, had I not been working with you on several of those television matches and your outfit as Aldo Montoya, had not, you know, wouldn't have, you know, inspired some of the things that came out of my mouth and, you know, force that conversation with Vince McMahon and allows me to forge ahead of Stone Cold Steve Austin. And we always had fun working anyway, and we always got along. And it's good to hear from
yes,
you.
Sir.
And I'm glad
yes,
that
sir.
You've come as far as you have. And I'm really glad to hear that you kicked the habit that had you down.
Thank you so much, man. It's always a pleasure, brother.
Well, let's stay in touch.
No, I will, man. Thank you so much, Steve. Really appreciate it.
All right, PJ. Take care.
Take care, Steve.
Thank you for joining us for another classic episode of The Steve Austin Show. Please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends. For more Steve Austin Show, go to podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good night! And welcome to T-Pain's Nappy Boy Radio Podcast, the most fun you'll ever listen to while you're folding your clothes. Now let's get this straight, this is not your average podcast. T-Pain's Nappy Boy Radio is super fun, super crazy, it's pretty much an in-your-face conversation. That's the good thing about us, we don't do interviews, we do conversations. All of my guests, all of my co-hosts, we chill, we drink, we play games, we have the song of the week, we have the creative curse word of the week, as long as you're having fun as our guests. Speaking of guests, each week I'm going to go through my whole contact list and dive headfirst into the world of music, gaming, exotic cars, tech, strippers probably, doctors probably strippers that are only stripping so they can pay for tuition to become a doctor. You never know. My wife is a certified bartender. She'll make you a drink while you're here. We'll get you drunk and make you play VR after. It's a lot going on, but that's what it's all about over here at T-Pain's Nappy Boy Radio Podcast. See you soon, baby!
Yo, what's good? It's your boy, Big Brother Jake, a.k.a. Jake Warner.
My government name.
Check it out. I host a show called the Big Brother Jake Podcast, and I've taken my talents to the biggest and baddest platform on the planet. That's right, baby. Podcast One. My show is unique as I talk about everything. Life, sports, entertainment, being a single dad juggling several jobs. I'm a hot mess, but it's damn entertaining. Subscribe and review now on Apple Podcasts and listen on Podcast One or wherever you get your podcasts.